new bipartisan plan to balance the budget.
This one calls for a national sales tax.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Wednesday, November 17th.
Coming up, a new way to measure the economy. How happy are we? Plus, Prince William's getting married, but at what cost?
But first, you've heard about the deficit-cutting plan from the leaders of the president's debt commission. Well, this morning, there's another. It's from the Independent Bipartisan Policy Commission, led by Pete Domenici, a former Republican senator from New Mexico, and Alice Rivlin, who was White House budget director under President Clinton. Marketplace's Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has a sneak preview.
Today's plan balances the budget by 2014. It lowers and simplifies income taxes and suspends the 6% payroll tax for a year. Co-chair Alice Rivlin says that puts a lot of money in a lot of pockets.
That's good from a spending point of view. We also are proposing that the employer part be suspended for a year. That gives employers an incentive to hire people or hire them sooner.
A new 6.5% national sales tax would replace the lost revenue. Also, Medicare premiums would go up and Social Security benefits would go down. Domestic government spending would be frozen for 4 years and defense for 5, says co-chair Pete Domenici.
We think the economy and its endangerment is more of a problem than military preparedness. Debt is a bigger security problem than anything else.
Domenici and Rivlin call their plan realistic, not surrealistic. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There's a report in this morning's Washington Post that says lenders are in negotiations with states to set up a fund. It would be similar to the one for victims of the BP oil spill, but this one would be for people who can prove they lost their home in a foreclosure that shouldn't have happened. Let's bring in Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
So this is the latest twist in the whole mess over mortgage documentation and foreclosure documentation. Do you think a fund like this would solve the problem?
I think it's a win-win. For people who have been wrongfully foreclosed, it gives them a venue to pursue an efficient and streamlined process of getting damages. And on the other side, the lenders who've been going through an excruciating media experience get to finally take this off of the front page.
Now, Richard, yesterday we got a report from the Congressional Oversight Panel on this whole mortgage document issue, and they said it could cause severe harm to the financial system, but they didn't seem to know the scope of the whole thing. Does anybody have a sense of how big this is and what the possible effects could be?
Well, the short answer is no. I have not seen a single reliable estimate of the total number of foreclosed properties wrongfully conducted. We know that the process is broken, but we don't know what the outcomes have been. So this is a big if, and it's another reason why I think it makes sense to try and move this all into a settled arrangement where people are finally trying to resolve it in an efficient way.
Richard DeKayser with the Parthenon Group, thanks as always for your time.
My pleasure.
There's word this morning one federal agency is investigating dozens of executives and employees at some of the banks that failed during the height of the financial crisis. Marketplace has confirmed the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation's Inspector General could help bring charges against as many as 50 former bank execs. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
More than 300 banks have failed since the financial crisis began. Only a few of those are under investigation, and even with those few, evidence of wrongdoing will have to be very strong, says Columbia Law School's John Coffey.
The process only begins with the FDIC. You've got to convince a U.S. attorney, who is the only person who can indict, that this is truly a criminal case in which real fraudulent activity occurred.
Coffey says that probably means showing that bank executives were lining their own pockets with bank money. But even though the cases might be tough to win, they're probably worth it for the FDIC, says Georgetown law professor Don Langvoort.
Yes, it's expensive, but it's a way of getting at least some money back. The FDIC has lost so much money.
About $180 billion so far. And there's an immediate payoff as well, says Langvoort. He says the public is angry and wants to feel like corrupt bank executives are being held accountable. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Today, the Senate will take up a bill aimed at making sure men and women receive the same pay for the same work. Supporters are calling it a necessary update to the Equal Pay Act of 1963. Opponents say it would lead to a flood of lawsuits. Let's bring in the U.S. Labor Secretary, Hilda Solis, who supports the bill. Good morning.
It's good to be with you.
Well, Congress passed the Lilly Ledbetter Act on pay discrimination back in 2009. There are other legal protections to deal with pay discrepancies between men and women. Why do we need the Paycheck Fairness Act?
What's really important to understand here is that women still earn only 70 cents on the dollar compared to men. And for African-American women, it's 69 cents. And for Latinas, it's 60 cents. So what we're looking at here is really trying to create and level the playing field and actually having the government help provide support, data collection, so that we can really look across the board to see where these inequities exist.
Congress is also looking at extending jobless benefits for millions of unemployed workers. What do you think happens if they don't extend those benefits?
It's going to be terrible. If this is not extended, and it will actually terminate at the end of the month, you'll see about 2 million people that will be impacted. It can mean a very harsh holiday season for many people.
Quickly, how long do you think until we get below 8% unemployment?
I don't have a crystal ball, but in the last 10 months, we've created well over 1.1 million private sector jobs. Right now, I think we're on the right course in terms of jobs that are added every single month.
Hilda Solis, U.S. Secretary of Labor, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, November 17th. I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at marketplace.org.
We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. In 2006, Boeing won a contract to build a so-called virtual fence along the U.S.-Mexico border. Now the project is way behind schedule and way over budget. Marketplace has learned that the Department of Homeland Security has granted Boeing a 30-day extension. The contract was supposed to expire today. Marketplace's David Gurra reports.
The virtual fence known as SBINet was supposed to combine high-tech surveillance tools with more personnel to prevent illegal border crossings. Randy Height reviewed the project for the Government Accountability Office. He says some big questions never got answered, like, how will SBINet work and how much will it cost?
Well, if you don't define those kinds of things, it's hard to be held accountable for anything. Whatever you deliver, you're saying, well, this is what we intended to do.
As costs went up to more than $1 billion, Height says the scale of the project got smaller.
From initially the northern and southern borders to the southwest border to just three sectors on the southwest border to two sectors on the southwest border, and eventually now to two locations within one sector on the southwest border.
Height calls it the incredible shrinking program. Two issues that contributed to the reduction in scope were geography and equipment that didn't live up to its billing. Jason Ahern oversaw the project while he was with Customs and Border Protection. Now he works in the private sector.
You have mountains, you have desert, you have lack of communications in some of those areas. So to being able to take some of this information and to be able to remote it to a command center is a tough, tough challenge for any contractor to do.
The Government Accountability Office recommended the program be revised. Earlier this year, Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano called for an internal audit. Boeing referred our request for an interview to the Department of Homeland Security. In a statement, it said, quote, Boeing stands behind its work on the SBINet system as a reliable, effective border security tool. In its own statement, the Department of Homeland Security said it's currently reevaluating the program and it expects to make an announcement about its fate soon. In Washington, I'm David Gurra for Marketplace.
But can a Chinese company compete with the likes of Boeing and Airbus? A Chinese airplane company has announced it's going to deliver orders, about 100 of them, for commercial jetliners. The Commercial Aircraft Corporation is trying to beat out Boeing's popular 737 and the Airbus A320 for the skyrocketing air travel market inside China. From Shanghai, Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
700 million people will be flying the friendly skies above China by the end of the decade. It's a market that'll be worth close to $500 billion. China's hoping its new C-919 aircraft will start cutting into Boeing's 52% share of that market. With all that business, Boeing's Randy Tinseth doesn't want to badmouth his new competitor, but he's not willing to give up market share either.
To follow the competition is a pathway to mediocrity, and we don't want to be mediocre.
For some Chinese products, mediocre might be seen as a compliment. And that's why industry experts question the foreign appetite for these new planes. But the C919's manufacturer isn't worried. That's because it's owned by the government, just like most airlines in China. In essence, it'll sell airplanes to itself. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There's a new happy couple whose pictures are plastered all over the global newspaper, Steve. It's Prince William and his future wife, Kate Middleton.
So lovely.
But many Brits are wondering how much their big wedding is going to cost. The BBC's Rebecca Singer has that story for us from London.
When Prince Charles and Lady Diana married 30 years ago, one estimate put the cost at $50 million for the event. But today, attitudes towards extravagant royal spending are very different. A royal spokesman has been quick to say that William and Kate will be mindful of the economic situation as they plan their big day. Mark Namirko is a luxury wedding planner based in London, whose couples spend, on average, $500,000. He says he doesn't expect this wedding will be overly ostentatious.
For sure, they'll go probably all out for the ceremony, have an amazing ceremony, which I'm sure thousands of people will be invited to, which the nation will need and will want. But I also feel that there'll be other more intimate aspects to their wedding day, for sure.
Royal weddings are typically paid for by the British taxpayer, but there are already calls for Prince Charles to foot the entire bill for the wedding from his personal fortune. But there is also a lot of excitement about what sort of boost this could give the nation at a rather gloomy time. Namirko says the wedding industry will profit from couples wanting to copy the royal stationery, dress and party ideas. And also, with billions of viewers from across the world expected to watch the royal wedding on TV, it could also be great publicity for British tourism. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, November 17th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Well, this morning we got the Consumer Price Index from the government, and tomorrow we're going to get an index of leading economic indicators. These are the numbers that we look at to measure how we're doing. But if that's the question we want the answer to, why doesn't the government just ask us how we're doing? Well, in Britain, there's where they're going to do just that, a happiness index. And for more on this, let's turn to Marketplace's Economy 4.0 correspondent, David Brancaccio. David, good to see you.
Good to see you, Jeremy.
Well, why are the Brits doing this now?
Well, it was a bit of a campaign promise by the newish British Prime Minister David Cameron. Britain will be one of the first countries to move ahead on this after French President Sarkozy and Nobel Prize winner Joseph Stiglitz were, among others, calling for countries around the world to start measuring well-being. Now, of course, the Brits don't often listen to the French, less the Americans. But Canada now does ask well-being questions of their residents, but it's not an official regular government stat, as is being contemplated in Britain.
It seems like it would take some courage for the British to be asking about happiness right now.
Yeah, you think? Given all the public sector layoffs in that country, it does take some intestinal fortitude politically. But here's the thing when you think about it, right? When do you want to start asking the Brits about their happiness? Fourth quarter of 2008, when we're tumbling into the economic abyss? The earliest they could get this rolling is maybe next spring. So maybe it's a bet by the British government that the business cycle will be on their side and that moving forward they can take credit for maybe happiness going up?
That people will actually say they're happy. What's wrong, David, with just measuring the normal stuff? Income, economic growth, stuff like that?
Those are all important, but they don't perfectly correlate with how well people are doing. You have GDP going up, maybe health care is not going up, maybe educational opportunities are not going up. So if you really want to know, so are we better off now than before, the crucial political question, you have to get data about this sometimes subjective idea of happiness, well-being.
And quickly, do you think we'll get an index like this here in the U.S.?
Maybe soon. We do have this thing, Measure of America. It's like a big report card. Just came out the other day. It takes a look congressional district by congressional district across the country at education, at income, at health care. It gives us a kind of happiness rating.
All right. Marketplace's Economy 4.0 correspondent David Brancaccio, who looks very happy here in the studio in New York. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
And finally, if you're looking to really wow the neighbors this holiday season, Jeremy, you can just grab this new Panasonic television set. It's a 3D TV, and it measures 103 inches.
That is a lot of inches. That's like 8.5 feet.
Did you just do the math on that? That's great.
I did. It's right in my head right now.
The price of this monstrosity, Jeremy, just over $100,000.
Oh, that's a steal for that.
But it probably gives off enough heat that you could use it, I don't know, as a space heater for the winter.
Maybe even a barbecue. You could get a lot out of that $100,000.
It's like a TV dinner. That would be great. Ooh,
absolutely. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. Our program, by the way, is produced by Jolie Myers, Ethan Lindsay, Vahan Baladuni, and Shelley Moulton.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis in Los Angeles. Jeremy, have a great day. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.